I'm Tony Mark.
And I'm Justin Cumby.
And you're listening to the Malibu Podcast. Malibu.
Ring, ring, ring.
Mark and Grether Group, how can I help you?
Oh, hey there. I was looking at some land in Malibu. It looks like it's about 7-8 acres for $60,000, and I'd like to make an offer. My cattle are going to love it. I'm going to put down some Airstreams, maybe a tiny home, and just live that country life.
Well, that's great that you want Malibu land, but unfortunately, none of that will be possible.
What are you talking about?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things in Malibu that prevent that kind of development. You know, there's part of, I think, what makes Malibu special is the fact that it has chaparral and, you know, wildlife. And even though the zoning is for it, many people are quick to learn that development sites are not what the acreage is. And so a lot of it comes down to development and how much you can actually build based on sensitive habitat.
So you're telling me that this is not as simple as buying a piece of land and it's your land and you can do what you want.
You know, I wish it was, because I grew up on a ranch and that's what I wish it was. But, you know, they're trying to preserve the Malibu character. So it's really a lot of agencies are involved. And to build a home, you know, we get calls all the time from people that want to put in hotels and put in vineyards. And unfortunately, it's just not as simple as it is.
Hmm. All right, then. Well, can you sell me a beach house for about $10 million?
Sure can.
All right, bye. Today, we are doing Land 101. I'm joined by our founding partner and newly minted member rejoining the podcast team, Russell Grether.
Thanks, Justin. Yeah, happy to be here.
When was the last time you did a podcast, do you think?
It was like the first one. When we interviewed Jay.
I think you did one of the market recaps at the end of the year.
That's true. Yeah.
And then you've just been floating around, actually.
Yeah, you guys shunned me.
No, I think you've been doing deals, and me and Tony have been in here recording.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you guys have kept it up. It seems like people like to listen, so.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. So today, I've actually wanted to do this one for a long time. We are very proud to be one of Malibu's top land teams. There's really only a small handful of agents that specialize in selling Malibu land, and I think that's one of our strongest points. Russell, in particular, this is kind of one of your specialties, right?
Yeah. You know, I started real estate probably about 18 years now, and my first listing was actually a 300-acre ranch that I ultimately sold up in up near Ojai. And so it was a crash course in all of the different facets of, you know, selling land, but also what to look for when marketing land. But when, you know, people come and reach out, you know, I actually think that in a lot of ways land is very simple to buy, because after a little bit of an education, it's very obvious to sort of point out what things you can look for.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, a lot of times, like you with that call, people come in and they say, you know, they have these grandiose dreams of building a hotel or building, you know, a lot of Airbnb, like, you know, Airstream properties where they can have 50 Airstreams on it, you know, and unfortunately we hate to be the one that bursts the bubble, but at the same time, you know, we also don't want buyers to feel misled, you know, and I think that there's a lot of agents out there that don't know the codes, and so they'll go down that rabbit hole with those clients, and, you know, there's always a possibility, so I don't want to be the killer of all dreams, but I think that the reality of the situation is that for properties in Malibu, both incorporated, which is the city of Malibu, and unincorporated with a Malibu address still within the Coastal Commission jurisdiction, that is going to be best well suited to have a single family custom home. You know, we get a lot of calls from people that want to put in a prefab residence. Blue Homes, they tried to make their mark, you know, on Canaan, and they had that one flagship home that, well, they couldn't make it because you still have to go through all of the different agency provision. You know, you have to have all the reports, all of the studies done. And so most of the time, people ultimately come to the conclusion that you have to do the same work, so you might as well put a custom home on it.
Right. Totally. And is the foundations, I mean, I don't want to get into the weeds, but a lot of the requirements, I mean, for a prefab or a custom home, it's exactly the same, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it all depends on the geology. I mean, the weight loads are the same for the most part. But I don't actually know, because I've never really seen it. I've never seen a prefabbed home go on a foundation where they had to lay caissons or anything of that nature.
Yeah. It's just not done all that often, for the reasons you're explaining, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. First, I wanted you to actually highlight a couple of your sales, because you've also done some of the biggest land deals in Malibu's history.
Yeah, we've been very lucky to represent some of the nicest properties. One of the sales that I'm most proud of, not because of the celebrity cachet that Madonna and Sean Penn used to own it, but it was actually a labor of love, because it was a 3-year escrow. It was a big, you know, dispute between the buyer and seller, and ultimately they still ended up buying the property, and it was just became a labor of love to you know, see that property kind of pass the finish line. And that one sold for $5.5 million, you know, many years ago. And so that was one of the biggest sales. I think it was the biggest land sale of that time, during that year. And then, you know, a lot of burnouts. I think we were the number one team for burnout properties, which was sort of a strange, you know, we felt honored to be able to help people, but we also were very, I would say, you know, we were torn because there were so many people that were struggling. And so we felt like we were in a unique position to help those, but it was a very strange time to be in the land market, because there were so many people whose lives, you know, my mother-in-law lost her home in the same fire, you know, all of their lives were ravaged by this fire. And so it was a privilege to help a lot of these sellers that realized that rebuilding a home was just too much for them to take on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It's there's been some bittersweet moments, very, very sweet people. The hard reality of some people just not being able to rebuild financially, whether it's a settlement or, you know, some people just didn't have the time in life to make it happen, whether it be age or just how busy they were. So it was a weird mix of emotions to work on all those properties. And that market's kind of, it's basically gone. I mean, the Woolsey fire, it was over 5 years ago. It's kind of a secondary market now of plans and permits and retrading for the most part.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, I think that one thing that somebody told me about the burnout market is that nobody, for the most part, that lost their home wanted to be a developer. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think I'm a little bit odd in that I've built two homes in Malibu, and I just absolutely love the process of, you know, getting the entitlements and then doing the build and seeing the change and the improvements. But nobody who lost their home, for the most part, wanted to take on such a big project. So yeah, it feels good though that we're kind of on the other side of that. And it feels like, you know, the communities or the neighborhoods that were hurt the most are being put back together. But yeah, that was a very strange era.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's get into today's topic. So I've wanted to do this for a while, because we get so many of those land calls. And with homes, often I feel like we begin our work with buyers as tour guides, right? We're looking at neighborhoods and lifestyles and house styles and, you know, do you want a pool? Do you want a beach key? Whatever. It's kind of like we are guiding people through the actual area then to the right house. land is a little different. It's the same in that we are tour guides to different areas in a more general sense, but we almost become, you know, professors or consultants because the first phase is education.
Yeah, absolutely. When somebody calls our team, you know, and Justin, I would say that you have become sort of my right-hand man, and I would say you're as skilled with land, you know, just by virtue of being around it so much. And I think you've really learned quite a lot in the last 5-6 years. So I would consider you also one of the top land experts now in Malibu. But when people call, the first thing that I want to know is how familiar are they with Malibu? Because a lot of people don't realize that Malibu is so long and the terrain is so varied, you know, and also what's their budget? Because you can have a healthy budget, but when you consider construction costs and the soft costs to get entitlements, and what I mean by entitlements for those that are unfamiliar, entitlements, you know, I always say there's a large spectrum of land. There's some land out there there's not even a survey. We've had sellers say, we think this is where our property is, but we're not really sure. And in Malibu especially, no property lines are very accurate. You know, we always say that unless you get a survey, you know, recently, property lines are, you know, even if they're marked with a fence, are within a few feet of each other. And so, you know, we have some properties that are on that spectrum where there's only, you know, just the title and that's it. You know, no survey, no certificate of compliance. A certificate of compliance is when it's basically an acknowledgement that it's a legal parcel. There were many parcels that were formed illegally back in the day, especially in the coastal zone, so unincorporated Malibu.
How would that happen?
I'm not sure exactly how it came to be, but to get a certificate of compliance, there is a formula in terms of criteria that you have to follow. And I think there's some properties that don't have legal access, they weren't recorded right, they didn't have the proper documentation. And so the first thing that we look for is, does it have a survey? Is there, you know, a topographical survey? Is there a certificate of compliance? Does it have clear title? You know, those are like the very cursory things that we look for when we're looking at land. And then there's a whole other spectrum of property that's, you know, you hear the word RTI, that's thrown around a lot. And I think that's more of an in-town term, but that stands for ready to issue. And so you have, on one hand of the spectrum, you have completely raw, seller doesn't have a single report, you're not even sure if it's a legally formed parcel. Some of them don't even have legal access. Like, there's a lot of properties up in Yerba Buena and up in the hills where 20, 30, 40 acres, and there's maybe a prescriptive use case where there's been a country road that's gone to the property over the years, but there's no recorded deeded access with an easement. And so you have that raw land, a lot of unknowns to RTI or actually permitted, where somebody's gone through the entire planning process and also gotten their building in safety. And we can talk about that in a little bit. But you also have the engineering done and they've issued the permit or it's ready to issue. You know, we have a lot of clients actually that make a very good living just getting properties entitled. And they are very good at identifying the low-hanging fruit in terms of, you know, if we get a geology report and we get a survey and we get some plans done by a local architect and you start chipping away at the risk of the unknown. Most buyers, I would say, are afraid of the unknown, and rightfully so, because it's so expensive. You traditionally can't get loans. You know, US Bank will do loans, and there's other banks out there that'll do loans, but a lot of times US Bank and other institutional lenders that are out there, they'll put you through 60 days of hell. And then they'll tell you in the last minute that the property has to have a septic system installed. And I've had this happen to me 3 or 4 times now where they've gotten you all the way down to the finish line, and then they say, oh, you know what, we're so sorry, but this property has to have a septic. You can't put in a septic without a permitted house. So it completely kills the deal. So since rates have gone up, we've seen a probably 60% of the market go to cash and the other 40% go to seller financing.
Hmm. Wow. It's like drinking out of a fire hose. But this is, I mean, this is good because this is kind of, this is where we begin with people, right? And so I've heard you kind of do this with people before, so I thought it would be a good kind of jumping off place into actual land evaluation. So just cursory, what is there and is this worth further investigation? And so I've heard you break it down into four categories before that are very specific to Malibu. And hopefully they're right, because if not, I'm not as good of a study as I'm getting credit for.
Well, I think there's two ways to value land, just in general. I'll start there. The first way that we like to look at land is obviously the probably the most common way at first is what is other land in similar size, characteristics, location, selling for? Not on the market for, but actually sold. There's a huge delta between asking prices with land and the actual sales price. The last time I checked, I haven't checked in several months, but the last I checked, it was like 70% of the asking price. So what that tells us is there's few buyers roaming around, and when they do buy something, they tend to, you know, come in aggressive. And a lot of times sellers, because they've likely been sitting on the land for so long, they don't want to reduce their price, and they know that it's a long game. And so they'll come in and accept an offer that, you know, a lot of times is very surprising to us. But the first way to look at land is what have things actually sold for? And looking at it from that assessment can kind of give you the best, I would say, benchmark in terms of a starting point. And then the second way is if you look at it from a reversed sort of cost analysis, I always like to look at what homes are selling for in the area, what the acquisition price of the land will be, and then work backwards. The construction numbers that we're hearing, you know, being thrown around, it's still a bit of a moving target for us. But for if we keep the constants, you know, and we keep the foundation traditional with not, you know, big caissons and, you know, soldier pile walls, and, you know, you can spend $1 million before you even break ground because you put so much concrete into the ground to stabilize the earth. But we've heard $500 to $900 a square foot thrown around for construction costs. And so if you buy the land for $500,000, let's say, and you want to build a 2,500 or 2,000 square foot house at $500, that would put you at a number that, you know, if homes are selling for $1.5 million in the area, then you know that the acquisition price is too high because it has to compute. Most people, developers or owner builders, want to have skin in the game, or not skin in the game, but equity, sweat equity, so that, you know, at the end of it, if they have to sell at any point, they will make, you know, 20, 30%, sometimes more. I mean, we've had clients make 100% on their money before. Let me know if I'm getting ahead of myself though.
No, I mean, I think when we're first evaluating land, that is one way, you know, it's numbers and logic. What have things sold for? What could it sell for? What is it actually worth? The other thing I wanted to get at was the kind of physical evaluation of the land itself. So we've already talked about having a, you know, certificate of compliance and being having a clean title. You know, that's kind of the paperwork side of this is a legal lot and it can actually be sold. I wanted to get into a few of the physical characteristics that are very specific to Malibu, like geography, ESHA, access, and utilities.
Okay. All right. Yeah, those are good. So a lot of times, you know, when you go back to that call, a lot of times when I start working with land buyers, or we start working with land buyers, is like you said, it's an education. And a lot of times, you know, people have the money and they have the dream to build their own custom home in Malibu, but a lot of times they are misled by the asking prices. And so the first thing that you want to look for is, well, putting aside that it's in a location in Malibu that you'd want to be in. So if, for example, you wanted to be in Western Malibu, you wouldn't even really look at properties, you know, east of Pepperdine. I would say that's kind of our cutoff, you know, mentally, of what we consider to be the division between east and west. And then from there, you go into what are the obvious things that you can look out for? What are the things that are going to be expensive to do? And so the thing that I like to look around for is, you know, where's the water coming from? Is it in the street? Does the property have a well? Is the well powered up? Do they have a test, a well report showing the gallons per minute? Do they have, you know, water already hooked up with a water meter? Where's the power? Is the power going to have to be run, you know, 100 yards from Edison, 200 yards? What's the driveway like? Is there even enough room to put a 20-foot wide driveway there? You know, the fire department now requires a 20-foot wide driveway with a, they call it a hammerhead turnaround, which would allow for a fire truck to come in, presumably fight the fire, and then be able to do a 3-point turn out of the property and turn around and leave. And so does the property even have enough space for that? And the other thing that you're hindered by is grading. So if you buy a property that's on the side of a mountain and you have to put in a 20-foot wide driveway, you might have to do caissons on the uphill side with a huge wall that goes up really high. And then you might have to do caissons on the downhill side, that so you could spend $1 million before you even get access to your property. And so that's why we see a lot of the, I would say, the $200,000 to $400,000 properties sit, because those properties, not only are they much more risky, but they're also a lot more expensive sometimes, because you don't know, you know, and there's all these requirements too about grading allowances, and you're only allowed, as I understand it, 1,000 cubic yards of grading before you need to get what's called a variance. And a variance basically is anything that is considered an exception to the regular building code. So in Malibu, in the city, you can by right, assuming you have a legal parcel with legal access, you can build up to 18 feet, single story. You know, even if you're blocking somebody's view, everybody is entitled to a single story home that goes up to 18 feet. But if you, for example, want to build a two-story home, you can go, I think it's 28 feet with a pitched roof and 24 feet with a flat roof. If you do that, you have to get a variance, and you basically have to ask for all the neighbors to give you permission, and it can add a lot of headaches. So a lot of times when we encourage buyers, you know, we want to make sure that they're not asking for any variances, because that can add years to the entitlement process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, variance can be a bit of a death sentence depending on what it is. But I remember there was a lot up on in Corral Canyon, and they had achieved, after years, they had achieved a variance, and the county had lost the paperwork. So that's where the plans were basically stuck, was we've paid this fee, but there's no record of the approval. I mean, to a degree, it can get crazy. Would you ever ask for a variance if you were building yourself?
No.
Yeah.
No way. Yeah. I think it's really, really tricky. I mean, there's certain parcels where they are far enough away from, there's a contestable zone as a neighbor if somebody's property is directly affecting you, that I believe it's either 500 feet or 1,000 feet. Hmm. You know, and there's some properties, especially off of like Ramble Pacifico, you know, the Big Rock area, where mm-hmm. they are 1,000 feet away from neighboring properties. And so it's really more of an administrative thing, because a lot of times those architects know that nobody will contest it because it doesn't affect anyone. Mm-hmm. In that case, maybe. But yeah, it's a really, you know, I don't think that land is as tricky as people make it out to be, you know, and I think in some ways that's maybe propped up the land market because it's thinned out, you know, the developers and the ones who are buying and developing land are sophisticated. But I think as long as you get a team of people, and where I've seen it over the years, where people really lose their shirt in terms of costs or time, is when they bring in their second cousin's sister's uncle who's an architect in town. They don't know anything about the Coastal Commission. The city of Malibu has their own LCP, which stands for Local Coastal Program. So when the city of Malibu was incorporated in 1991, they basically adopted their own coastal program. I believe the Coastal Commission still has the power to overrule a approval for an LCP for the city of Malibu, but they rarely do, as far as I understand it. And so once you get your permits in Malibu and you've gone through the coastal development hearing for the city of Malibu, it's more of just a administrative waiting game until Coastal approves it. But I think that as long as you have a team of locals, you should be able to build and to get something done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who you work with is really everything, and having experience or grit, but it's, you really, both is the best combination.
Yeah. We've cultivated relationships with a lot of different, you know, geologists, archaeologists, surveyors, biologists. There's a lot of different agencies that have to sign off on these reports, you know, septic engineers, on-site wastewater treatment designers. You know, as long as you get that entire team in place, they know what to do. And it's really interesting to see, because a lot of these guys have been in the business for, you know, longer than I've been alive. And so it's been really fun to work with, especially a lot of these geologists who have been working in Malibu for 30, 40, 50 years. You know, they know a lot, and it's really fun to get to work with them. But they're going to be the ones who from the get-go can say, don't touch that property with a 10-foot pole.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's they know, because they've probably built 10 homes in the area, what the geology is going to be like just by interpolating the data that they've obtained from doing borings at the other adjacent sites.
So you brought up our LCP, and I did want to touch on that. So I believe it was in the 80s, a huge portion of the Santa Monica Mountains, something like 80 or 90%, was labeled as ESHA.
I'm not sure exactly when it was labeled, but I sort of joke that ESHA is a four-letter cuss word that we hear a lot. And whenever I hear the word ESHA, it makes the hair on my neck stand up, because, you know, on one hand, it's a blessing because I think that it's preserved the rural and it's kept the integrity of Malibu and the mountains. And, you know, the fact that I can go hiking with my dog on a trail and not see any homes, you know, right from my house is pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, that's where I think a lot of uneducated buyers will lose their shirt, because they think that you can develop a 40-acre parcel. But if it's anywhere near ESHA, you know, H1 is the worst. That's,
so let's rewind for a second. What is ESHA?
So ESHA,
if someone does not know,
ESHA stands for Environmentally Sensitive Habitat Area. And it used to be such that special habitat was reserved for just riparian zones, seasonal streams, oak tree groves, you know, places that were very lush and verdant and, you know, generally kept a lot of life just throughout the summer. But over the years, they've sort of expanded that reach. And there's H1, which is the most, those are rock outcroppings, riparian zones, streams. You can't touch those with a 10-foot pole. You have to be at least, I think it's 200 feet away from those. And so they have buffer zones. And then they also have H2, H2 special, H3, And H3 is what you are looking for, which is, previously disturbed grassland, properties where they have not been labeled as sensitive habitat. That's where you can build and landscape the biggest swath of land on your property. But for example, if you bought a 40-acre property and then it was, let's say it was on a steep mountain. Mm-hmm. And the most logical site would be to have it on a pad. If the pad was in H1, you could not build there. And if you could build, let's say it was H2, you would still have to be at least 200 feet away or 150 feet away from the H1. And then you would be limited to, I think it's a 10,000 square foot building pad, which to have a quarter of an acre on a 40-acre, and that includes the house, the driveway, the landscaped land around it, if you have a pool, 10,000 square feet, when you're talking about some of the houses that go up in these areas, it's pretty remarkably small.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. I had another question, something that we actually were talking about the other day, significant ridgelines. So those maps are actually pretty widely available. They're kind of all over going through these mountain corridors, especially where you're finding these, $200,000 to $400,000 lots. What does that mean if one runs through a property?
So a significant ridgeline is basically a ridgeline that I don't even know who made the determination, but they've basically, it's what it is. It's a significant ridgeline. And I think what they're trying to do is make sure that if you are driving up Canaan or hiking on a trail on the backbone, or you're in the, any one of the trail systems or any one of the neighborhoods, they don't want to see houses that are popping up on the ridge, ruining the skyline of what is a preserved ridge.
Like so Gothic castle.
I mean, exactly. That's, yeah. So I think, I know that PCH has a view corridor and they really want to try to keep PCH as pretty as possible. But the idea is that the ridges are relatively kept intact and you're not able to put a giant house on the top of the mountain and completely obstruct with the natural, beautiful geography of the mountains themselves. And so what people have to do is they, a lot of times, will have to set their homes down. And so you can still build if the land is big enough and the restrictions against it, with Etcha or, and so sometimes what people will do is they'll notch it into the hillside and kind of have it come set down. But then you got to be really careful about grading, because if you exceed your allowable grading, then you would need a variance. And so it becomes a little bit of a Rubik's Cube in terms of making sure that all of the different parameters can be met.
Yeah, and that is why you work with the professionals. Okay, well, quickly before my last kind of segment, I thought we should cover is kind of general price ranges. And, with all things, rules are meant to be broken, but the general adage that, if it's too good to be true.
It's super good to be true. It probably is.
Yeah, it probably is. Land, pricing for land, everything we've talked about goes into that. I think the additional variables is its location in Malibu, its distance from the beach, and how desirable the specific community is. But land does fall into kind of these general ranges that, we've worked in all of them, so we're quite familiar. Do you want to go through? I had kind of lobbed them into.
Yeah, I think that it. Generally, I would say there's sort of the lower end price point, which is under 500,000, and there actually are some good parcels that are less than 500, especially there was a period of time where there were some burnouts, and even now there's still some properties off Latigo, Old Chimney, where the neighborhood is sort of built up around it. So, there's utilities nearby. There's fire department access, there's fire hydrants in the street. But the limiting factor up there is the home price and what you could have after you build the home in terms of a valuation. I would say that anything under 200 is probably not worth the effort.
What about the lots you see for like 60,000? Because we get those calls. I mean, that's, people use that as a credit.
Oh, they're junk. Okay? Yeah, they're completely junk.
How does that work when people buy it and then donate it back to get more square footage? Is that
so? My understanding, those are called transfer disclosure credits. Those are called TDCs. And there's a lot of properties that, like we were talking about, they don't have legal access. They're cost prohibitive to build. And so my understanding of it is that when the city of Malibu incorporated, they said this many lots are going to exist. And it's like 15,000 parcels. And so you have some of these parcels where they want it, – it's basically a bartering system. And so people have bought these junk parcels and they deed restrict them or donate them back to the city or the Coastal Commission or the MRCA. I can't remember which agency takes them. But then they say, okay, well, we're going to give you this parcel, but in exchange for doing that, we want a little bit bigger of a house, or we want a little bit more of a allowance with regards to how much yardage we can grade, or we want to be able to move our setback just a teensy bit. It's definitely a bartering system. You know, sometimes I would call it extortion, but I think that it's a way for people with deep pockets to build what they want with less obstacle.
Mm-hmm. So they are useful. And I think the only other use is if you're buying the property next to you, just to enlarge your ownership. Every once in a while, some of these properties, especially in Ramble Vista or Ramble Pacifica, will have deeded rights to the La Costa Beach Club. So that's a big value add for people. But generally, a lot of these too good to be true lots are just absolute junk.
Yeah. You know, I always feel bad for people. You know, I feel like the killer of dreams when I have to be, you know, and I'd rather people kind of rip the Band-Aid off than tease people along and waste their time and mine, you know, for properties that I know are not going to be useful. Mm-hmm. And the dream is still alive and well. You know, there's still tax sales from people that just stop paying their property taxes because they just get foreclosed on from tax because they know that it's not even worth paying the tax to keep them. But I would say, yeah, there's generally under 200 is useless unless you get, like Justin said, beach rights or some sort of other added amenity, or you can use it as a TDC. But generally, I wouldn't touch those with a 10-foot pole. And then between 200 to 500, I would say you're getting into an area where there might be some diamonds in the rough, but the margins are very thin for the most part. And I would say that you have to try to find properties that have some level of entitlement work done to mitigate as much risk as you can. Mm-hmm. And so if you can have a geology report done or a survey or easements that show that it has legal access, you know, a lot of times, especially up in the mountains, they have roads that don't even line up where the easements are. So you got to make sure that you have, you know, a surveyor come and overlay that the easements exist where they're supposed to. But there are definitely some opportunities in that price point. And then I would say the next price point is probably between 500 and 1.5 million. You know, I know that's a very big range, but again, it just depends on where you are. You know, there was a great lot that sold off of Calpine, which is in Malibu Park, for 1.3. And it had, you know, homes. It was a complete infill site, which means there was development all around it. And it was unentitled, so it sold for 1.3. But for sure, you'll be able to build something there.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll
be worth 6-7 million.
Yeah, and that'll be worth, you know, a decent amount of money depending on what you can build. But to me, it's not so much about, well, it's part the money, but it's also the risk assessment in terms of, I would not personally want to take something on if I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it out the other side and make some money or get my home permitted and built. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the lots, you know, really what you're paying for when you start getting above 500,000 is you're paying for the insurance policy that the risk profile goes way down. And it's not a question of if, it's a question of when or how you can build something. Mm-hmm. And then above, I would say above 1.5 to 3, that's kind of the...
It's premium.
That's premium.
It's good stuff.
But it's generally, it's not on the beach. It's not on the bluff. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's in Malibu Park. It's in neighborhoods that are established. And I would say that the build out value for a lot of those neighborhoods is anywhere between probably 5 and 8 million. So a lot of times those do pencil. You know, we have one right now on, 30103 Harvester, which is a burnout. And they are on their way to getting permits for a 4,600 square foot home. And we have that listed for 2 million. You know, there's homes in the area selling for 6, 7, 8. So there's definitely upside. Mm-hmm. And I think those are the ones where it's like, okay, if you want to build your dream home, that's the area where I would be looking.
Yep. 100%. So, gosh. Land 101.
I think everyone's asleep at this point, probably.
Yeah. Good night, and we'll see you next time. It's just really, it's pretty wild just how deep the rabbit hole goes. And I think as an agent, you're kind of you're that first touch point who is going to help people make all those connections. So, I don't know, having that wealth of knowledge to start with the education process and then actually being local, having experience, having those connections, I think those are absolutely essential to evaluating and purchasing or selling land in Malibu.
I think, yeah, I mean, if I could leave all of you with one takeaway, it would be to open your eyes and just observe the basic characteristics of a lot. Look at how much the houses are selling for in the area, how much are they asking, and then find the average of what the size homes are in that area, and then do the math and say, okay, well, if they're 750 a foot, then, and they're selling for, you know, 4 million, but the lots are asking 2, you know, those won't pencil in terms of being worth the money. So a lot of times what we see actually is clients will pivot and they'll start looking at land, and then they'll say, you know what? I don't want to go through years of headache. I want to build something now. I want to buy a house and enjoy it and then renovate it. And renovating is it's another avenue that people can go down where you can add square footage. You don't have to go through coastal commission unless, you know, if you're reinventing the whole home and adding tons of square footage, then yes, you would. But there's a lot of ways that you can phase out your construction so that you don't, so you stay within certain categories and you're not treated as a coastal development permit, but you're considered, you know, what's an APR. But I'm getting off topic again. So if I was going to leave you guys with anything, it would be just focus on the general characteristics. Is the site hilly, flat? What do the homes look like around it? Is there any sort of strange vegetation? Was there a creek running through it? You know, if you have a creek, it's a benefit, but you just don't want to be too close to the creek because you won't be able to build on it.
Right.
And then also look around at where utilities are. You know, where are the power lines? Where are the water meters? Where are the fire hydrants? All of that stuff can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars before you even get started.
Well, obviously this is all pretty general information, but it's so helpful to have perspective as you start looking. And again, working with the right person is essential. So if you are looking for something or just even want the general education, it's a pleasure to serve the community and sell a lot of land in Malibu. And hopefully this has been helpful.
Yeah. Yeah. We're here, like Justin said. And I would say that as a team, we take pride in the customer service and really just, you know, I sometimes joke that we know enough to get ourselves into trouble, but that's why we have all the experts who really know every detail and nuance. And that's the team that you need to really determine and try to mitigate your risk. But it's definitely possible. I'm looking for my next property too.
Right. And on the sell side, that's another one of our big specialties. I think our marketing is second to none, our presentation of the land. And again, it's just the local knowledge. It's being able to communicate what's actually there, help sellers price land, which can be very, very difficult, and ultimately get the job done.
Yeah. Yeah. Call us if you want a sales pitch, but I would say that nobody does land marketing better than us.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, dude. Russell, thank you for honoring us once again with your presence. We're looking forward to having you back very soon.
Thanks. Yep. You've heard it here. I'm committed to doing this more, and I want to become more active. I've really seen what you guys have done, and it's really great. So I want to get more involved and start joining the fun.
We're lucky to have you. This is Justin Cumby for Russell Grether and the Malibu Podcast. We'll see you soon.